Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
Well, notwithstanding the temperature.
Indeed. We are on probably the coldest day of the year today, and it is. I'm feeling it. Let's just put it that way. And of course, we are also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Good. I'm just writing a letter to the IEC to ask them why they are stealing our vote in a household where I've calculated there are three people who at least missed seven elections because they weren't allowed to vote on the basis of race. And now the IEC seems to be keen on stealing the vote again. So I'm a bit grumpy. But we discussed that yesterday, and we have other things to talk about today, and I look forward to that and being with you guys.
Indeed. Right, so let's get stuck into it. And today, of course, we are going to be covering a story that I think popped up last week. It's based off of some reporting that's been going on for a while, but it's, I think, really a sign of the new age that we are entering now. And that is a Israeli firm, I think called... I've already forgot the name now. NSO, I think. Yes, NSO Group, yeah. Has apparently developed some software, some spyware for spying on people's cell phones and communications. Apparently, the spyware was developed back in 2016, but subsequent versions have been created since then. And originally, this product was designed to be used by governments to infiltrate criminal networks, for example, like the mafia or something like that. But of course, the technology to spy on people's phones does not, it's not only a good technology, of course, it has been used by very many nefarious actors. And so a group of journalists from The Guardian, as well as Amnesty International and some other NGOs, have been digging into who this software appears to have been used on, and some data was leaked last week that these groups published, which shows that a number of world leaders' cell phones had been targeted by Pegasus software at some point. So apparently the latest versions of this software are so advanced that they can simply call you on WhatsApp, and even if you don't answer the call, it can install the software on your phone. And then it records every keystroke that you make with your phone. It records all of your phone conversations, so it's pretty hectic stuff. The world leaders identified, there were 14 in this data leak, but they include Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, French President Emmanuel Macron, and of course, President Cyril Ramaphosa. It's unknown whether his phone actually, I think, was infiltrated and whether anything was stolen. There's also some suggestion that the Rwandan government might have been behind this, but I'm much less sure about that stuff. So let me start off with that. Sarah, what do you make of this? Do you think, why would Rwanda want to do this? Why? What do you think they might get out of Cyril Ramaphosa? Is this a huge disaster for national security? As we've seen in the past week, our security forces are not really up to snuff, so I would be a bit worried.
Well, can I just start with us not being up to snuff? I don't know. I think we all got that little video of television interview with Beckett Tele, which the interviewer asked him, and I can't remember the name of the chap, is still, what is it, head of the spy services or whatever term he used. And he said, I don't know. So we are not up to snuff. But frankly, I think
there's so much to know. You know, how can you know everything?
He said, but Minister, are you saying that you don't know his name? And Becky Dele says,
don't. I mean, it was like, oh, it was wonderful. It was actually almost Monty Python-esque in reality. I think the only thing the Rwandan government would be interested in from a South African president would be anything that reveals the whereabouts of somebody that the Rwandan government wants to kill. They murdered one of their erstwhile allies, I think you said, in 2014. One was murdered at the beginning of this year. I think that's the only information that would be of any value to them whatsoever. Rwanda doesn't I don't think doesn't need anything from South Africa. I may be wrong. I also think it's probably a little bit boring, but it does strike me as spyware that is best used to ascertain whether an affair is going on. And maybe if it was used for that purpose, it'd be used for future leverage, shall we say. But I don't know why they would otherwise bother.
Yeah. It's worth saying that the company says that they require government clients to use their software for legitimate investigations into terrorism or crime. But I'm not really sure how they could enforce that. Gabriel, what do you make of all this? And what do you make of the larger problem that we really seem to be entering into an age where hacking is a real, real big deal? So, of course, all the Trump collusion stuff that went on in the US was driven by this fear of hacking the election by the Russians, in part. But we've also seen serious stuff happen, like a major pipeline getting shut down in the US and other bits of infrastructure that have been hacked. I think even the National Health Service in the UK was hacked about 2 years ago. Mm. What do you make of all this? What do you make of the software?
So on the Sororama Poser side, I do feel like taking a small stroll into the absurd. There is this wonderful conspiracy theory going around that a large, well-funded, highly disciplined cell unit army nearly took over the country last week, and that we should be very relieved that our excellent intelligence services are currently monitoring 12 or 11 insurrectionists. Because if they weren't monitoring them, then surely the union buildings would have been invaded by now. If one is going to go for conspiracy theories, I think one might as well go for the conspiracy theory that Ramaphosa himself launched the insurrection, timed it so that the voting registration, which was supposed to happen at the end of the week, didn't have to happen. You could postpone that, get the Moseneke IEC report to say that we can't have an election in October, push it through to February, which is when we're likely to have a new variant and a new wave, which is a point at which we won't be likely to have an election. Then you can postpone it again. Once you postpone it twice, people enter into real chaos, and the kinds of events of last week will be fairly common as municipal government is officially dissolved around the country from November 1st under the mandate of the Constitution, and provinces have to take over. And you can hand out free goodies in the meanwhile through social grant systems. I mean, you know, if we're going to go wild with conspiracies, let's do that. And of course, if one had the president's keystrokes and phone calls all to hand, one might be able to prove or disprove such a theory. And maybe the Rwandese were after that. I think that sounds about as implausible as anything. I think on the serious side, that the commercial, I mean, that private persons do and should worry about this. There's a kind of arms race between the white hats and the, you know, forces for nefarious ends. And whether it's big companies like Microsoft or small businesses that manage wealth or logistics, I know two in the last 2 years that have had all their data stolen, held to ransom, and have had to pay in excess of R1 million. And they've called the police and said, can you help? And they said, no, not really. You can pay and then get your stuff back, or you cannot pay and see what happens. I think that this is just a constant arms race, and it does seem that the balance of forces is tipping a little bit against against the good guys. And at the same time, I think what's really strange is that I find myself in the position where I worry about the phone I use. I worry about the laptop I use, sources, you know, being exposed or being hacked or for whatever reason. And yet I'm still use WhatsApp. And I have two, 3-point verification or whatever on my laptop. But I still kind of, I mean, I think the most nervous I've been about my laptop is I went to go get it deep cleaned because I was worried about a water droplet getting in there. And they said, well, you just tell us out your password so that we can log in to check that all the functions are working. And I was like, no, I can just not tell you my password. There's a lot of work product on there and you're very unwelcome to have my password. I will come in. But that's about as far as I go in terms of actually managing this. And I think that a lot of this technology is old enough that we all know how to use it, but it's not old enough that we know how to use it responsibly. And responsibility is just this classically liberal concept of something individual, of really each person kind of doing their little bit. And so as much as the race is between tech-heavy geniuses that can do things on a screen that I don't understand, it's also a race between our own complacency and our own paranoia and the slow lurches forward into that happy balance that I think is best described as responsibility. So if the story is of any worth, I hope it's that it helps in that regard. But as for the president being hacked, I must say, I feel rather cold about that. Yes. Just at the moment, even though he is my president, our president, I'm just sort of searching the basement level of my emotional empathy and finding it quite empty.
Indeed. So it's actually interesting that in 2019, WhatsApp took Pegasus, the makers of the Pegasus software, the NSO group, to court for their spyware, saying that it was negatively affecting their customers and causing damage to them. So it's interesting how they seem to be joining in the fight here. I think WhatsApp is also currently fighting a legal battle with the Indian government, who wants to weaken end-to-end encryption that WhatsApp uses in its messages. And so WhatsApp is fighting that at court now. I think it's also, on a complete tangent here, interesting that it seems like the country that seems to have been worst affected by this hacking software has actually been India, but it didn't make international headlines until Emmanuel Macron and Cyril Ramaphosa's phones had been hacked. Whereas in India, you know, I think it was something like 100 major celebrities with millions and millions of fans got their phones hacked, and it didn't make any news outside of India. Sarah, any more thoughts?
Not really. I just would hazard a guess that the one world leader who's name wasn't on the list to be the Prime Minister of Israel.
Yes. One suspects. Anyway, we'll have to see where this goes. So far, we don't know whether any data was stolen. We just know that these were potentially targeted.
Yeah. And just to say, I mean, I think if one knew that data was stolen from the President of the Republic of South Africa, one would have to be a bit worried. Because there might be some national interest put at risk. But short of knowing that.
Yeah. Anyway, let us go on to our next story. And we wanted to cover this yesterday, but we didn't have time because we were focusing on other stories. There's some interesting comments made by political commentator Moletsi Mbeki, who is, of course, a very unorthodox political commentator. He often has a pretty unique take on things. He's also, of course, Thabo Mbeki's, I think, his brother. I'm not sure if he's a half-brother or a full-brother. Yeah. But anyway, Moletsi Mbeki gave an interview to Biz News recently where he said that there wasn't really an aspect of ethnic mobilization in the riots. He said, in my view, Cyril was targeting the whites, the white prejudices, let me say. He wanted to tell whites that they are these Zulu bloodthirsty savages, but he's going to deal with them using the army and the police. That was his strategy for allaying the white fears. Of course, the whites believe that they are Zulu bloodthirsty savages who have to be dealt with by deploying the army. That was the intention. He knows there was no such ethnic mobilization. Cyril knows how to manipulate the white population. He plays on their prejudices. He manipulates the black population as well. He was caught on camera a couple of years ago. He was on campaign in Polokwane, and this old lady in the township said to him she is not going to work for the ANC anymore for service delivery reasons. Right. Ramaphosa thought that, Ramaphosa thought the camera was far away and wouldn't hear his reply, and he told her, you know, if you don't vote for the ANC, the Boers will come back and take the land back. He's a real racial opportunist who manipulates both whites by playing on their fears and prejudices and the blacks by playing on their fears and prejudices. So, Gabriel, you had some thoughts about this. Is he right to say that ethnic mobilization was not a big factor? And also, I assume you agree with his characterization of Cyril Ramaphosa as a racial opportunist.
Yeah, I think that's hard to doubt if you, you know, track Ramaphosa's record of saying there's no farm murders, of not responding to the very credible allegation from Ambrosi posthumously that Ramaphosa told him the long-term plan is to boil white people like frogs, not in the sense of killing them, but in the sense of slowly eroding so many rights that by the time property is taken directly, people won't really have a way to stop it on the basis of race. Didn't say much about that. I think it's kind of odd that Ramaphosa, that the Bosasa scandal, which is still ongoing, like how did Ramaphosa's campaign get funded? Well, you know, his son, who went to Hilton and grew up with a billionaire parent, got a BEE deal. Like, that's the scandal to me. I don't, like, one way or another, whatever the evidence shows beyond that, that'd be interesting. But, like, the scandal is that Ramaphosa thinks it's chilled for his son to get a BEE contract on the basis that he's previously disadvantaged. And that's another little race hustling moment. I think Moelesi Mbeki is interesting because he was a trained Marxist, I suppose, in a way, to coin a phrase. But so is most of my sort of Russian family, and very few of them believe in communism, right? Marxism, in a certain sense, can just be a set of intellectual tools rather than an idea of how society should be run. And so when you look at class warfare and you do the kind of material dialectic analysis that Moelesi Mbeki does as an architect of poverty, he finds his arguments against BEE for title deeds and against expropriation without compensation, which he predicted would be the ANC's next move back in 2009. By saying, well, just look how the class and power structures work. You have this elite that's invested in securing its position, in reducing competition, in passing on to its children the advantages of connection to power by legislating away and, in the course of so doing, distracting people with silly ideologies. You could now call this silly ideology critical race theory, but there are earlier names for it. So Moelesi Mbeki is interesting because he uses this Marxist language to make the argument for free markets, for civil liberties, and against race-based policy. Likewise, I'd like to use a kind of background language that I've tried to develop of esteem markets, where you think of cultures, ethnicities, races, all of these sort of groups that that people identify themselves willfully or involuntarily as basically having at least the following two features. The one is that there can be a goal associated with a group, right? So Zulu-ness can aim to achieve such a status that everyone else is a second-class citizen and only Zulus are first-class citizens, and being a Zulu is defined by bloodline. And that's very much the kind of policy that the African National Congress runs, not for Zulus, but for Black people. Sort of BEE is our people, this kind of language, and the legislation around EWC and BEE and so on tries to achieve a group result that is subnational. But there's another side to culture or ethnicity or these esteem teams, which is just that once you have people kind of all speaking the same language, kind of, and I mean that both in the literal sense of an actual dictionary language, but also in the sense of using the same terms within that language, following the same fashions, and liking the same charismatic figures, then you just have these open channels for communication. It's kind of easier to have your message reach someone if you speak in an accent that falls readily upon their ear. So I think that there is something to be said about the fact that so much of these protests took place in KwaZulu-Natal. I think there's something to be said about the fact that in Gauteng, the riots do seem largely to have started around well-known Zulu hostels, Jewel Street, Vosloorus, and so on. And I think that the way of understanding that, which is what Moelesi Mbeki says in his way in the article, is that there's this established charisma and language thing so that the message goes through more quickly to those areas. But what is absent is the goal. There was no indication that the goal of these attacks was to put Zulus above Xhosas or Pedis or Vendas or Zulus above whites or Indians. The goal was to show complaints against Zuma being arrested. The goal was to steal stuff for oneself. The goal was to flex. And the goal from Zuma's children and his allies, in some sense, was to throttle white monopoly capital. So there's some kind of race baiting involved there, but no Zulu mobilization that I can really find evidence for. So I think Mualesi Mbeki's right. And I think that it's something a little bit dodgy about saying he's playing on white prejudices. I think that there are lots of non-white people who have prejudices against Zulus, who kind of have a stereotypical Shaka picture in mind. But I get where he's coming from, and I think that it's a brave and very important point to make.
Yes, I agree.
Vis-a-vis the broader point that that we have these kinds of insurrections on a daily basis, and we don't usually scapegoat them in the kind of way that people are trying to do now.
I think tribalism is sort of the one prejudice that doesn't seem to make elite circles too often, and yet it is quite a, I think it is a current that runs through parts of South Africa. And like you said, I've heard a lot of non-Zulu South Africans of all races characterize Zulu people with negative stereotypes, not just whites. Claims that they're uneducated and brutish or things like that. So I agree with your last point there. Sarah, what do you make of this? Do you agree with Gabriel? What are your thoughts on what Mbeki Mbeki said?
I think it was very, very strange because, I mean, there's no particular sense that whites thought much about it at all, about the ethnic quality, or I certainly wouldn't put it past Ramaphosa to try and exploit it. But I think it was like that was a miss. It didn't quite work. And as you both said, you know, it's not confined to the extent that there are such stereotypes. It's not confined to the white population by any means. In fact, I think the last time the white population really feared the Zulus was probably in 1879. But what it's such a strange, because it wasn't the thought that it didn't cross my mind at all. I mean, it may have been comments that the comments that were made were just, I thought that the comments of a desperate man who wasn't quite sure what to do and was trying to mobilize some sort of support, and people are saying, I don't get it. It's not that it made an impact of any kind whatsoever. So I thought Cyril sounded like he was rather desperate. And I think Mualesi kind of overanalyzed it out of existence. It was very strange because Mualesi is usually a fairly astute observer of our body politic. And this just struck me as odd, both what Ramaphosa had said and what Mualesi said he said and why he said it. So I think it's just one of those weird moments in crisis.
All right, so let us move on to our next story briefly, because we don't have that much time left, and that is about the Tokyo Olympics. So they seem to be sort of fairly cursed. There have been lots of problems with them. People resigning. The chairperson of the Olympics said that women talk too much in meetings, then refused to apologize for it, then apologized for it, then resigned. We've had lots of little sort of mini scandals, sometimes people being upset that someone used a Nazi analogy here, or someone complained about COVID protocols there. And there's also a lot of protest against the Olympics in Japan itself from people who either don't want it because it's expensive or don't want it because they think it's going to cause a super spreader event for COVID. Because Japan, not being that badly affected by COVID, has only begun to roll out its vaccination program quite late. So a lot of people there are still very worried about the disease. And the latest is that the organizer of the opening ceremony, the opening committee, has resigned. He is a comedian. And in 1998, while doing a comedy show in Japanese, he was doing a skit where he pretended to be a children's entertainer. And one of the characters who's on the show with him says, "Aren't those dolls from when you tried to do that Let's Play Holocaust segment on your kids' show?" It's kind of difficult to explain without watching the clip itself. You can probably find it online. But basically, he made a joke about the Holocaust, and it was a very short one and a very passing one in 1998. This came to light, and he apologized for the comments, the joke, and has resigned just before the opening ceremony. And I can only imagine the stress of whoever his replacement is currently having to take this over. Sara, what do you make of this and the Olympics in general? And also this question that an article has asked before, can something as horrific as the Holocaust ever be made fun of?
Okay, well, look, I don't think we know enough about Japanese culture generally to understand Japanese humor. So I think it was a, you know, they could have smacked him on the wrist a bit on this one. With regard to just can you make jokes about the Holocaust, is I actually think you can, but not often successfully. And probably best if the jokes are made by Jews by and large, because it's really uncomfortable territory. The thing that there are a couple of incidents at the Olympics that really cheese me off. The one was that the officials, the marshals, I don't know what you want to call them, would not allow a Paralympic swimmer to have her mother act as her sort of guide or whatever they, you know, her official. They would provide their own. Now, bearing in mind that this particular swimmer is deaf and blind, and I kind of figured that a little more humanitarian response to this is probably in order, but they wouldn't move, so she withdrew from the Olympics. That's almost funny if it weren't sort of so sadly tragic and unnecessary. And the other one was a woman's, I don't think it was a beach volleyball, but it was beach something or other, softball or something like that, that they're taking part in, and that they were being, a particular team was chucked out because they would not wear the regulation bikini bottom. They wanted rather to wear, I think, but probably short shorts. Now, it brings out the feminist in me in that I've never understood why it's taken them so long to move away from bikini bottoms as an official dress regimen at the Olympics. So I kind of would go with the girls wearing shorts. They've been chucked out because they're not wearing, well, it's not G-strings, but something fairly close to that. So there's an element of you know, fast tragedy turning to tragedy and back again with the Olympics. And I think a sort of 23-year-old really bad Japanese in Japan comedy routine on the Holocaust is the least of their problems.
So, Gabriel, there isn't much time left here for you to respond, but do you agree with Sara? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I disagree. I think that people must make jokes whether they're Jews or not. Adorno once said there can be no art after the Holocaust, and then he came to regret that statement. I've watched the whole clip insofar as I can make sense of it. The joke is, is quite clearly not that the Holocaust was a good idea, but that someone trying to reenact it with puppets is a bad idea, a sort of laughably bad idea. I think that is quite funny. It's a sort of passing joke in a 20-minute sort of Waiting for Godot-esque skit. You know, every death is a unique, terrible tragedy, and people make fun of death. It's kind of how we deal with life. It's one of the bows in our quiver. I think what is most telling about this is that this thing happens in the 90s and has been brought forward today on the events organizers, the best day in his life, what should be the best day in his life. So people call this kind of thing cancel culture. I call it maybe sort of social sadistic vandalism. There's clearly some sadistic element by those people who brought it forward today. And shame on them. I think that if our... Anyway, I feel pretty bad for the Japanese. I think it is a wonderful country that really needed to have an opening up, bringing in tourists, kind of persuading its citizens that are still a bit skeptic about having fun with foreigners, that it's a great thing to do, that you can make money by doing it, and sort of get more international travelers to buy into Japan as more than a kind of stereotypical Tamaguchi techno quirk. That has failed to happen because of the plague, and I think that the Olympics should have been delayed, but it hasn't. And so a great opportunity has been missed.
I think also an opportunity has been missed for having fun with foreigners and spouses having access to Israeli spyware to check on the fun that their spouses were having with foreigners.
That's how you tie everything up. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening to us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please support the IRR, which of course funds the Daily Friend. You can support it by becoming a friend of the IRR. And then when people ask who funds the IRR, you can say I do. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed and have a wonderful day.